Hello, and welcome to Hard Fried History, a hybrid history
and comedy
podcast run by two aspiring entertainers.
Podcast, it's more of a rant, really.
That have failed at almost everything else.
I don't fail because I don't try, so there.
We appreciate you checking us out, and if you want to see extra content, follow us on Instagram or give us a like on Facebook at Hard Fried History.
Subscribe to us on YouTube or tell us we're full of shit on Twitter at HFH Podcast.
Feel like going that extra mile? Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Or wherever you're listening, and leave us a flattering, a glowing review.
And of course, tell your friends, family, and even people you don't like about us.
That's right. Again, thank you for listening, and without further ado, the episode. Welcome to another episode of Hard Fried History. Today we are concluding our series on Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Last time we left off, we did a court packing episode, but as far as the trilogy is concerned, Hitler had just violated the four-power agreement by annexing the rest of Czechoslovakia, leading to the what is commonly regarded as the general outbreak of World War II, and that brings us into Act One of this episode, which is called Towing the Line. So the main thing that FDR has to cope with, struggle with, deal with at this time is in September of 1939, he's trying to repeal the Neutrality Act, which forbade the sale of weapons and arms and munition to either side of a war. It says that you couldn't sell any of these things to quote unquote belligerents is the word that it uses, and it doesn't give any sort of credibility or exceptionalism to who caused the war and what cause they're fighting for, any of that shit. It's just like, we're not getting involved. You know, you can't sell anything. And
yeah, I mean, which is, yeah, you just want to stay. I mean, just staying out of a conflict is, yeah. It's like, I understand the sentiment, but this isn't the one to stay out of, big dog.
This isn't the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
This is.
You got to go all in on this one, right? And FDR realizes that, but the public, the general public and Congress specifically do not.
I think, I don't know if you have to go all in. You can just go very strategically, very early. And what I do mean by that is kill Hitler as a baby. Invent the time machine.
I don't know early if the on. New Deal funded time machines. I mean, I know they had Einstein, but I don't know if he was there yet. You know what I mean?
Who said
they were more focused on Manhattan Project? They couldn't. Maybe there was like a secret program underneath the Manhattan Project that was about time travel. Perhaps.
I mean, maybe Einstein invented it, just didn't tell anybody. Maybe it's a state secret. Maybe we have a time machine.
I would love to believe Einstein didn't die. He just went, but he just orchestrated something that would look like his own death. And he's the doctor. He's just fucking around.
I don't think the doctor. Time. Yeah, that's just Einstein. Well, that's just Einstein, one of the doctor's many forms, Doug.
That's just one of his forms, but just one of his lives, man. He used it as Einstein, and you know, life well spent, right? Mm-hmm. FDR is pushing back against Congress and the general public. They're still too isolationist. He keeps on Congress in particular keeps on referring to FDR's attempts to get rid or circumvent the Neutrality Act as repealing our neutrality, which kind of yes and no, you know.
Yeah.
FDR, he shifts to a more like cash and carry basis as a loophole. No U.S. funding, no credit, no bank loans, no U.S. transport. But if they want to buy it from us, yeah, I mean, that's capitalism, isn't it? That's commerce. Why wouldn't we? If they're the ones taking the economic risk, so to speak, then we would be fools not to sell them war equipment, right?
I mean,
pretty slippery.
That can be applied to anything.
Yeah.
And then that can be applied to anything and have like a bad outcome.
it depends. You know, it's a case by case basis, you know.
Hey, these kids are going to buy drugs anyway. Why not get them from you? Like, what?
These kids are going to buy weed anyway.
These kids are going to buy crack and heroin.
There's definitely lines. There's definitely lines to this. Within those lines, right?
I mean, they're going to get somewhere. All right.
Cool. They're going to get November 2nd, 1939, the repeal of the Neutrality Act passes. The question then shifts to whether or not FDR will run for a third term, which is, I think at this point, still unprecedented. And, you know, there wasn't specifically an amendment yet that said you couldn't fucking do this. But there's been a strong precedent established ever since Washington neglected a third term that FDR is now like, do I violate that or do I do what is perhaps better for the country? But he explains to like an aide that he's fucking tired, dude. He wants to sleep. Okay.
How is it? How is it better for the country? Like, he could step aside and have like a crony run it.
But what if the wrong dude won and he didn't get involved in World War II at all? Isolationist won the office?
I mean, that's
allowed Hitler to come to power in Europe.
But that's up to the people. Like, I mean, I can the third termerism is, you know what I mean? I love FDR, but third termerism, I've seen how Africa has dealt with that.
Family. I see what you
They have good reasonings also. They have like, look, if I stay in power because there's another rival tribe, that, you know, I'm the only person that can have this peace brokering. And then they just start buying jets, fam.
Yeah.
So like,
You know what? I think we should have a new constitutional convention. I think we should rewrite this shit, you know, which surely people were raising that concern and they were afraid of it. But he explains to a friend, he says he's tired. He said he actually wanted to start writing history. That he had not a book deal, but like a regular publishing deal on the line with Collier's Magazine. And he was maybe I'll do that shit. And he tells the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgenthau, he would only run for a third term if things got worse in Europe. That's his whole deal.
It's going to get bad. There's no, this is after,
and he was like, I'm definitely going to run, but he can't say I'm definitely going to run. So he has to say like, you know, I'll run if the sun comes out tomorrow. It's like, of course, you know, one of those things.
Yeah, no, it's FDR is like the only king America's ever had as far how it was felt for people during this time. But still, you get two terms, nigga.
The American Caesar. I like
you get two terms, fam.
At this point, there's no choice but two terms. But hey, you know, you win if you have an. I said this about Carrie Nation way back when.
Yeah,
I'll say this about FDR now. Yeah. You win if you get an amendment written after you, right? You've had an impact. You can debate the merits of that impact, but
with that same idea. Look, when I sold drugs to these kids, it wasn't illegal yet. These weren't
exactly.
Nobody knew what crack was.
Didn't break.
You got a lot of bad reasons.
You still destroyed family. It wasn't illegal to say that the vaccine was gonna make you more sick than the disease would, right? It wasn't illegal to say such grossly irresponsible things on television yet. That doesn't mean that you didn't have a real world impact and people died because of it. Anyway, May 10th, 1940, Neville Chamberlain resigns over in Great Britain, which means your boy Winston Churchill.
Not my
comes,
boy.
Not your boy. In he comes sense. Into power.
In any sense.
after the fall of France, Churchill cables to FDR. He says, I trust you realize, Mr. President, that the voice and force of the U.S. may count for nothing if they are withheld too long. And so FDR more or less responded to this. He requests funds to modernize the army and the navy. The army was about, for the American army, that is, was only about 185,000 strong at the time, ranking 18th in the world, which is kind of a very foreign thought. compared to now. You know, like the idea of the U.S. Army being 18th in the world is like, is unacceptable now. But
yeah, because they didn't. It wasn't like we weren't the superpower.
No,
we were just one of the powers.
We were just like, we were coming up, you know.
Yeah,
just young pup coming up, and young pup becoming a big dog, right? The biggest dog.
Okay. See, we haven't incorporated you into like the big dog family, so like you can't just be saying big dog.
Yeah, it's because I'm a young pup, man. I'm trying to break in. I'm asserting myself. I'm putting my elbows on the table. Okay.
I don't want to hurt your feelings. Let's move on.
Okay, right on, whatever. With the help of Chief of Staff George C. Marshall, the weapons of war machines to be sold to Great Britain, they start to funnel through rather than like the government itself. I guess Marshall has some contacts, of course. Yeah. They're sold to Great Britain through the Curtis Wright. It's just a company called Curtis Wright and U.S. Steel. And so like the rest of 1940, FDR is fighting isolationism. There is the quote-unquote Century Group. Who was like, I think in Congress pressuring pushing for war. And they're also trading American destroyers for Great British or British bases. And this is like a successful thing. This is how destroyers and more weapons and shit are funneled to Great Britain is on the basis of this exchange. Maybe they don't want to accept money, or maybe Congress doesn't want to really accept. It's an acceptable arrangement, you know. It's like we're isolationists, but the idea of acquiring more foreign bases abroad is almost too good to pass up. Is what I'm trying to say.
It's a loophole.
FDR is trying to dangle this carrot on this stick, and the carrot's too small, and now he's found the right carrot. He's like, what about foreign military bases abroad? And it's like, maybe isolationism is bullshit, you know?
I mean, yeah.
Which does kind of set the precedent for the whole Cold War. And it is like a legacy of FDR's, is how much he framed the Cold War. And by all means, he was, I think, an imperialist. Like he was, but he kind of recognized that the game was changing.
He didn't Woodrow Wilson it at the end.
He didn't pat it.
Yeah, he had been to France just going back and just like getting it. But that's like after. What he would have said about it at the time.
Yeah.
If he had lived to see it, but that's a whole different thing. But for sure. He wasn't a freedom fighter.
No, not exactly. And so 50 U.S. destroyers are shipped to like Halifax and intercepted by the British Navy and taken over to fight in Europe, because I think like Halifax and Nova Scotia was the furthest they could go. And in exchange, the U.S. gets bases, military bases in the Lesser Antilles, which helps kind of solidify U.S. control of the Atlantic, and more specifically as sort of this satellite orbit hovering around South America broadly. And then there's
Nova Scotia is in Canada. So Canada's in the war.
Oh yeah, aren't they?
Yeah, it's because Britain and Canada. So like they're going to just a British base, basically.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then again, through 1940, he's campaigning for re-election, his third term against Wendell Willkie, and he wins. And Willkie, Republican candidate, the main issue that he's using to try to divide the public is FDR's warmongering. I would like to call it a single issue election. Yeah. And FDR, he makes repeated assurances that American boys wouldn't be sent to fight in foreign wars to like multiple different crowds. He says this. And then his boy, Sam Rosenman, his like longtime speechwriter at this point, he says, why are you saying American boys wouldn't be sent to fight in foreign wars? Why not just say wouldn't be sent to fight in foreign wars in case of attack? And FDR says, well, in the event that we're attacked, it wouldn't be a foreign war anymore. It would be a domestic war if we were attacked.
This is how FDR begins to set up
Pearl Harbor. This is how FDR begins to set up Pearl Harbor, boys. So there are multiple times he told all these admirals to stand down. And he did it.
You really got to work on your Alex Jones voice.
I don't.
You got to come from a guttural place. You gotta come from a guttural place.
I thought you're just doing Batman right now.
No, you gotta come from a guttural place. Night,
you know.
Look,
where is he?
They turn the frogs gay, which is actually a valid story. That that's a hold up. That's a weird thing. That thing is weird. And man,
we don't have time.
We don't have time to break that down.
I wish we had more time. So another thing that FDR does in order to take the wind out of Wilkie's sails, so to speak, is he brings on.
Just one more thing, Alex Jones, the CIA plot.
Alex Jones is a fucking false flag. Let me tell you that. Okay, he's a false flag. If you listen to what this man says, you are being duped by the deep state. Okay,
the deep state is false.
Yes, he's inoculating you by telling you that the media lies, and then also lying to you. Is that you're more like, oh, he wouldn't lie because he told me that he's lying. It's a sort of hiding in plain sight thing, so to speak.
Everything he touches is now false, but if he touches the real story, it becomes, okay, but that's the whole thing.
That's, you know, some semblance of credibility. Long story short, Alex Jones, false flag operation. If you fall for his shit, you're a dupe and you're a pawn of the deep state. Moving on. Big money. All right. What FDR does in order to take the wind out of Wilkie's sails is he brings on into his own cabinet Colonel Frank Knox as Secretary of the Navy, and Secretary, he names Henry L. Stimson as Secretary of War. And this is announced like right before the Republican nominated convention. The reason I bring this up is like Frank Knox, I'm not sure particular, I think he like was a Republican or at least like right leaning. And then Henry L. Stimson was actually he worked for two previous Republican presidencies. He was like in the cabinet of I don't remember exactly which ones. I think Hoover and one other Republican president. He was like deep in their folds. And the fact that like FDR is now saying like, oh, you guys are more or less on our side when it comes to the war, I'm going to name Republican known Republicans as members of my cabinet. It makes him appear a little more, a little less like a belligerent, I guess. Or it's like, I have support across the aisle on this, you know?
It's inside the beltway. It makes him look like a bipartisan guy when nobody gives a, for the people who care about that in the suburbs of something.
You're middle seat voters, you know? He's like a very shrewd move, but also like, you know, Stimson's, as far as I know, was capable in office. I'll say that.
I don't trust anybody from this era.
I understand. Early December of 1940, FDR gets a brief respite on the USS Tuscaloosa after he wins re-election for his third term, and he's recharging. And while on the Tuscaloosa, he gets a cable from Churchill basically saying that Great Britain couldn't pay for anything. And it would be a shame if Great Britain fell, basically the last nation standing aside from Russia in Europe, if Great Britain fell on the basis of economics. So is there anything you can do, bro? Is there any way we can make this work? And this is when FDR begins cooking up Lend-Lease. Like, let's just figure it out, man. Let's supply Great Britain on credit. And this is the first thing that he talks about. January 6, 1941, his State of the Union address. It's devoted mostly to him talking about Lend-Lease, but also this is where he announces his international support for the four freedoms, those being freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear, and that the U.S. should play a role in ensuring, and all nations should play a role in ensuring these four freedoms, you know?
Okay. All right. Why not here, though? Why not at home?
Yeah, why not at home, though? You also got shit to worry about at home.
A lot of big talk going on outside the confines.
Yeah, but you ain't walking, my man. You know?
You ain't walking what you're talking.
Yeah. Come on, bro. And the bill passes, as far as Lend-Lease. Senator Robert Taft, Republican from Ohio, I believe William Howard Taft's son, he makes this pretty famous statement about Lend-Lease where he says, lending war equipment is a good deal like lending chewing gum. You don't want it back.
It's See, that's let me tell you something. That's 1940s thinking, big dog. That's not thinking like that's not thinking like a modern day analyst.
No, yeah, that's not thinking like that.
You do want it back, because guess what? Guess who you can sell off brand used equipment to? Smaller third world nations to fund to fund their wars. But guess what? Also a domestic market to police.
If you and they don't care that it's used. They care if it works, man. Yeah, you know, that's what they give a shit about.
Oh, why is Ferguson? Why does this small city have fucking tanks?
Don't worry about it. That's 1940s thinking. That's a chewing gum, man.
Yeah,
that's a chewing gum, man.
Nah, you get it back, and then you
share chewing gum. You're gonna get diseases, all right? And that disease is violence.
You get that? You could share. You could repurpose it, baby. Mm-hmm. Sell it to everybody. That's the whole thing.
There's money to be made, right?
Yep.
Shows what you know, Robert Taft. Come on, fucking scrub.
Noob.
June 18th, 1941, at a meeting with, this is probably the one of the only pieces of civil rights legislation FDR passed, meeting with A. Philip Randolph and the NAACP head, this guy Walter White, with FDR, Henry L. Stimson, Frank Knox, and LaGuardia. And their concern, A. Philip Randolph and Walter White's concern, is that black workers are being passed over by defense contractors. Mm-hmm. They're not receiving their fair share of jobs. And the NAACP had been planning a march of 100,000 of the disenfranchised on Washington. And the FDR kind of toggles back and forth for a little bit. I don't remember the exact story, but the end result is that he issues executive order 8802, which banned discrimination in the defense industry and the federal government because of race, creed, color, or national origin. And that's about the only thing he did.
In the Defense Department?
in the defense industry and the federal government. Privately, I guess you can do what you want. Yeah.
That's okay. I mean
woo.
In the Defense Department? No, I don't know.
I mean, I guess he was responding. It could have been more broad, certainly.
Yeah.
But the issue specifically was the defense jobs. And I'm sure there were other people concurrently saying at the same time, like, only the defense industry.
No, I'm saying soldiers can't fight like black troops and like the kind of maltreatment them still be having to have white officers during World War II. I've watched something about the jobs that black people had in factories and those not be. I know it's in the Ken Burns documentary, but I'm blanking on like the exact experience and how it was. But I'm pretty sure there's a fair amount of discontent.
Yeah, for sure.
So like, I'm not sure this one really solves it, big dog. But you know,
yeah, no, it could have gone further, certainly.
yeah.
But I think the whole thing was like cooks too. Is that like a lot of black soldiers were cooks, given the position of just being cooks or custodians, and I want to fight too, man.
There's mad examples of like people who having PhDs who like tried to join the Navy, and they were like, "Oh, you can cook."
Yeah, man. And it's like, actually, if you were to look at it, there's kind of a long-standing tradition dating back to like the Civil War and the 54th Massachusetts and Robert Smalls and fucking the Buffalo Soldiers and the Harlem Hellfighters. It's kind of a long-standing tradition of black people fighting for this country, and here you are saying cooks, really? That's the best you can do when this shit has been happening for a while now, you know?
They barely let, I mean, you could go down the list, the Jackie Robinson incident being like the one that always kind of gets me, that he's like in this fucking tank. He's in the triple nickel, not triple nickel. He's in the 761st, and he's fucking, and he's ready to go to war. And then he like gets kind of angry at like a local like train because they let like Germans sit in the front. They didn't let him.
That's fucked up. That's fucking.
And he's like in the uniform. He's like,
yo, what the fuck? Yeah. Like, yo.
I mean, but that's
really
like, yeah,
this
that's,
is
that's
it.
The whole thing. Like that's for sure. Yeah. All right.
The summer of 1941, and I don't want to get too deep into the causes of Pearl Harbor because I do want to do like a bonus episode of it, because we've done enough reading on it that it would be pretty easy to throw together. And it does deserve, I think, a deeper dive as the months leading up to Pearl Harbor. But anyway.
You got to tell them it's hard. Don't tell them it's easy.
I know. Ah, right. There we go. Yeah. You're right. You're right. Neg the audience. That's what I'm forgetting to do. Neg them. Summer of 1941, FDR suggests freezing Japanese assets because some other guys in his cabinet have been pushing for an embargo of like stops. Hey, maybe stop selling them petroleum, which is kind of fueling their whole war machine. And FDR is kind of really toeing the line, really taking a moderate stance. He's requiring the Japanese to apply for an export license before each shipment of petroleum and oil. And these licenses are controlled by specifically the Foreign Funds Control Committee, which is chaired by Assistant Secretary of State Dean Acheson, who would go on to be Truman's Secretary of State, I believe. And Acheson, he had sole authority on the release of frozen funds. And like, while things are heating up with Japan, for a while, FDR was away meeting with Churchill. And so Acheson decides not to unfreeze the assets whenever they apply for a license, because Acheson, at least the way John Edward Smith makes it seem, believes that the US shouldn't be selling Japan oil and petroleum and steel and whatever. I think steel was already in place, but he doesn't believe that the US should be sending Japan anything, especially like after the rape of Nanking and all this horrible shit that they've been doing and all this territorial expansionism. And he's like, no. And so FDR just doesn't overrule him, which pisses off the Japanese. But the Japanese were also kind of trying to toe the line with America and make sure that their supply lines, America, was still selling them petrol, was still open. So then July and August of 1941, there are 4,400 U.S. Marines deployed to Iceland. FDR and Churchill meet at Newfoundland, and they get along famously, you know? The FDR pledges to become more and more provocative, and if the Germans wanted, they could go ahead and attack, because again, he knows if they attack, then it's no longer a foreign war, because you know they hit first, and so we're going to hit back, right?
Yeah.
This is when they also announce the Atlantic Charter, which is basically the, like, I've heard it framed as like the founding document of the UN, and it said it commits both the US and Great Britain, I believe, to like freedom of the seas, national self-determination, the renunciation of territorial aggrandizement, the loosening of trade restrictions, which of course, you know, sometimes you want, as a developing nation, sometimes you do want those trade restrictions. You want high tariffs. That way your own economy can develop. So again, there is this sort of neo-imperialist bent to FDR. And also like a general arms reduction across the globe.
Again, these are great ideas, but like the walkthrough and the follow through by the UN has been, you know, I mean, we could just talk about the Congo.
Talk about the Congo. Yeah, it's like, what about this document that you guys sign? And it's like, don't you understand that in America, we have a long history of signing documents and doing the exact opposite?
We got great ideas over here, big dog. We got great ideas, man.
Yeah. We're great talkers here, and we're great at committing ourselves to noble ideals. It's much more difficult to follow through.
It's a lot.
Yeah, it is. It is.
You got to wake up, follow through. Yeah, that's crazy. Mm-hmm.
September 1941, over in Japan, Prime Minister Fumimaro Konoye is pushing for a meeting with FDR. He says through Japanese Ambassador Joseph Gru that Japan actually supports the four freedoms that he announced in his inaugural speech. Fancy that, right? And Stimson, Knox, Harold Ickes, and Henry Morgenthau are all, good portion, a caucus in his cabinet is against the meeting, because this would amount to appeasement and the memory of like Chamberlain's failures at Munich and the Four Power Agreement are still fresh in their mind. And it's like, are we really going to do the same thing with Japan? Plus, we already have allies in China, that being Chiang Kai-shek, Cordell Hull, Secretary of State, he wants the State Department to conclude negotiations. This is what he's saying to Gru, who's passing it on to the Japanese government, saying the State Department is going to conclude negotiations with Japan. We're going to hash out a good agreement, and then FDR is going to meet with you guys to solidify it after we've worked out those precious deets, you know?
Because it has to flow in the correct, like, the correct amount of dominoes have to flow. You can't just go fucking meet.
Like, you can't just ring the bell at the front of the White House and be like, is the president home? I need to talk to him. Like,
that would be a dope country if you could. Also, if they were friends with, if they allied themselves,
if they knew Kashi, man, it's no big deal.
Then they were allied with Mao. And you,
there's that.
I know we haven't mentioned his name on this podcast in a while, but we always got throwing him out.
He's around. He's still there, man. He's still lurking in the shadows, chilling. Is he chilling in Jing and Chan at this point, or is he moving about?
I'm forgetting. it's Jiangxi, and then he's in Yainan right now.
There's a recurring segment on this podcast. Where in the world is Mao Zedong?
Yeah.
Okay, that's right. That's
everywhere, fam.
Everywhere. He's in your closet right now.
Yeah. Anyway.
October 16th, of 1941, Konoye resigns. Shit falls apart. Emperor Hirohito asks Tojo Hideki to make a cabinet. And he advocates pursuing negotiations until November 25th to reopen those supply lines of petroleum and oil. That way they can continue to gobble up Southeast Asia, basically. And if the U.S. doesn't open those lines, we're going to attack, right? That's what he's saying to Hirohito and Hirohito's cabinet and his advisors and everything. We've done a three-part series on Hirohito. It's way back if you want to listen to it.
Yeah, no, we got that. Gosh, we got shit for days. All right.
We've checked this box. All right.
Yeah.
November 20th of 1941, Cordell Hull, Secretary of State, is negotiating with the Japanese ambassador in the U.S. Japan's final offer is a six-month cooldown period between the U.S. and Japan, which involved the lifting of the oil embargo, and Japan, in exchange, would withdraw its troops from Indochina. Meanwhile, I think it's in Oahu, there is the magic decoder, Oahu, Hawaii, of course. The magic decoder is, we can read basically all of these encrypted Japanese communications and what the Japanese government is communicating with the Navy, I presume, meaning that the U.S. knew about this November 25th deadline set by Tojo Hideki's cabinet.
Yeah.
That eventually gets pushed to the 29th, and the cabinet, or FDR's cabinet and FDR himself and the people around him, they suspect a Japanese attack, but they don't know where and they don't know when, really. They have a rough idea. They know they can, you know, they can read the tea leaves, right? They know shit's getting worse.
Yeah.
And they know they can suspect, they're astute politicians enough to suspect Japan's next move.
Yeah.
But the details, the devil is in the details, you know?
They thought it was going to be in the Philippines. I don't know why.
Somewhere where it would make sense.
It'd be in the Philippines. That was like the big one. They were like, yeah, it's going to happen. Because from my understanding, they already like bombed the Philippines. There already been like little like skirmishes and shit.
There's already been like, oh no, we're not at Bataan Death March yet.
Before. No, I'm talking about before.
We're leading up to Bataan Death March. But there's,
Bataan happens right out. Because it's actually part of a whole attack thing, from my understanding.
Yeah.
Because then you're going to Midway and then you're going to follow up where they give, you know, the Bataan Death March in Philippines shit. But nobody thought it could be that far in. And they didn't, from my understanding, they just couldn't see, like they came in under the, like a thunderstorm and like maintained, maybe that's what we're,
And just like complete radio silence. Yeah,
radio silence.
On the way, as these ships are just moving through the waters, they know that they need to preserve the element. They know that the only way this attack is going to work is if they preserve the element of surprise. And so that's what they do. But so November 27th of 1941, Admiral Stark alerts Admiral Kimmel of Hawaii and Admiral Thomas C. Hart to suspect a Japanese attack. He basically tells them to be on guard, be on the lookout. There is an official communication passed down throughout the Navy saying, hey, prepare yourselves. It's not looking good. So the idea that FDR or anybody for that matter told anybody to stand down because they suspected it, in fact, the opposite, right? Nevertheless, and I want to talk a little bit about like why this happened after I get the details out. December 7th, 1941, you have Pearl Harbor, of course. The warning issued out by the Navy generally was not taken seriously by Admiral Kimmel. And although MacArthur got it as well, and MacArthur had put the Philippines on guard, General John L. DeWitt on the West Coast in like California had taken it seriously, as well as General Frank M. Andrews in Panama. My basic contention, and it seems like John Edward Smith's contention as well, is that the U.S. took Hawaii for granted and fucking, you know, Admiral Kimmel took Hawaii for granted. The Navy in Hawaii didn't install these anti-torpedo nets because they assumed that no torpedo could successfully penetrate the shallow bay the ships were stationed in, right? Yeah. And there was Japan had only just invented this fin torpedo that could work in shallower waters by October of 41. If you wanted to say that Pearl Harbor was an inside job, you would need to prove that the magic decoder knew about these shallow fin torpedoes. There was some official communique that said we had from Japan to their Navy guys saying we have these torpedoes that'll work in shallow waters. And then the U.S. acting on that information would then countermand this naval order saying to be on guard. But it was more like, oh, well, Pearl Harbor's in such shallow waters anyway. They don't have this specific type of torpedo when they did. And that's what made, and the fact that like, it's such a bold move to go for the US Navy. It was like, no way in hell they'll do that. You'll have to be, A, they don't have the torpedoes. B, you'd have to be crazy disciplined and like crazy bold in order to do that. And it's like, well, they were, and they did. Yeah. So you had some underlying assumptions that you just didn't fully examine, you know, hubris.
And we all know what happened at Pearl Harbor.
Yep.
Yeah.
But some people just want to say shit. Just want to say outrageous shit. Hey, when they know nothing about it. You know,
we already did the Alex Jones portion of the show.
So the final casualties of the Pearl Harbor attack, 18 U.S. vessels are taken down, including 8 battleships. 175 military aircraft are destroyed. Another 159 are crippled and need renovations, need repairs. And 2,403 U.S. servicemen die as well.
Yep.
This gets us.
But they did not get them carriers, though, big dog.
Didn't get them carriers. That's needed, man. That's what you needed.
Nobody knew it's just going to be an air war, basically. Yep. It wasn't going to be the same type of war. So it was like, actually they missed the most important part, which is the carriers.
The most important thing. It was
because they were out.
It depends on how you look at success is whether determining Pearl Harbor was a successful attack or not. Like ultimately, no. In the immediate term,
but nobody knew fucking it was that warfare had changed and that because Midway is the first battle where people fight. And they don't fight first naval battle where people are fighting and they can't see each other.
Yeah.
So it's a different, it just becomes a whole different fucking thing. And that's
the shit has changed.
Yeah.
So getting into Act Two, Into the Storm. December 11th of 1941, FDR writes a message to Congress asking both houses to acknowledge the US and Germany were at war. And this is, there's been a lot of like nudging and cajoling on Churchill's part as far as, hey, I know Japan just attacked you guys. They signed the, you know, the three power agreement. I need you. Can we do Germany first, please? Is Germany first good with you guys? Can we do Germany first? And it's like, yes, Germany first.
Okay. Yeah.
January 6th of 1942, FDR gives his State of the Union address where he calls for the American economy, the American industrial sector to manufacture 60,000 airplanes, 45,000 tanks, 20,000 anti-aircraft guns, and 6 million tons of merchant shipping for that year alone. So he's like, all right, we've gotten our industrial sector mostly off the ground at this point. The American economy is looking better. Mm-hmm. I've done okay. We've all done okay. We've all done good, as a matter of fact. Let's put this bad boy into full gear, right? Let's gear up for war. Let's fucking do it.
Yeah. That's how you can increase the economy by just hiring more government workers. But also, funny thing about this, what's the guy's name? You know, the admiral?
Kimmel?
No, the Japanese admiral.
Yamamoto?
Yeah, Yamamoto. I'm afraid that we have awoken a sleeping giant.
Yeah.
And then that's what the American economy was. Because it's all just fucking factories at this time.
Yeah.
It's all like Detroit was actually like a popping place to be.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And it had all the factories were open. Like, that's what it was like. Oh, yeah. No, so we can produce like everything. It's kind of crazy. It was kind of far away where you can't.
I imagine like, Yamamoto just also in correspondence with the Japanese government just being like, being so mad and just be like, bro, they were isolationists.
They were gonna
stay the fuck out of this, you know?
He's the Pearl Harbor guy. He did Pearl Harbor. Yeah,
he wrote the planes up. Yep.
He just fucking didn't carriers weren't there.
Yeah, he didn't get those carriers, man.
I get those carriers, big dog.
That's a grand prize.
Knock out the carriers. Right? Yeah.
And then another blemish on FDR's reputation, February 19th of 1942, he issues Executive Order 9066, better known in the American public consciousness as Japanese internment, ended up in the imprisonment of 120,000 Japanese citizens, mostly on the West Coast. And so as Japan advances across the Pacific and the U.S. public kind of begins to comprehend what a defeat the U.S. Navy suffered, they became convinced that such an attack as Pearl Harbor couldn't be accomplished without internal saboteurs. And so really reading this after I've read all the stuff about Germany in the 20s and 30s, it's really kind of our rendition of the stab in the back myth.
Yeah.
And it resulted in a similar practice. Granted, you know, there are differences. Important differences, of course. But
one's a little bit further than the other. But
one's way further than the other. But still rounding up people of one ethnicity and putting them in camps. April through June of 1944, you've got some very important developments in the advancement across the Pacific. I'm not going to go into that much detail. Just go watch The Pacific. It's a good series. Tokyo was bombed. You get the Battle of Coral Sea, your boy Chester Nimitz, your boy Admiral Chester Nimitz outmaneuvers Yamamoto, the architect of the Pearl Harbor attack at Midway. He wins that shit. And then mid to late June 1942, FDR approves Jim Nass, which is later renamed Torch. And this is Churchill's advocation of like an invasion of North Africa rather than Russia's desire for a cross-channel attack to lure off German troops from Russia, because at the time, like, German troops were moving toward the Caucasus, which are the Caucasus Mountains and everything, and like Georgia, Azerbaijan, near that area, which is very oil rich. So you don't want Germany to get all their hands on all this oil, because who knows how long this shit's gonna go on.
Right? All about oil. This is like everything.
It's all about oil. It's
about resources, like actually getting, and that you can't. Armies need oil.
They need oil, man.
They need food. Better than The Pacific is a good series, right? But like, if you want like the full like battlescape of the entire like Pacific campaign, first you go Midway, the movie Midway, and then you go Guadalcanal, okay. Fucking hairy. And then you've after that, if you just want to skip through it, you might go with the Code Talkers. If you really want that type of vibe, you can do the Pacific now, but I would prefer you do Sands at Iwo Jima, and you get John Wayne as a Marine.
Yeah, I mean, Sands is good, but I'm just saying you get the full gist with the Pacific, you know. If you want to go that deep dive, watch them all. But I'm saying if you got to watch one, you got to watch one to get an idea of how the whole campaign went. You know,
Sands at Iwo. I'd rather watch Sands of Evil. There are a lot of ones.
That's
I'd
just Iwo Jima joke. That's just like 1945, 1944.
It's Tarawa. You know? It's Tarawa also. 1944 is Tarawa.
Oh, okay.
Was it 1944 or 43? Yeah, nah, that's Tarawa. Come on, Tarawa. Come on.
You don't get 42. You don't get Guadalcanal. You don't get Midway, man. You don't get Rabaul. You don't get
Guadalcanal. Emblematic of the entire Pacific fighting. It's changes, baby.
You gotta get Pele Lu.
I can name ones that they didn't get. They don't get the whole.
Okay,
fucking,
fair enough.
They don't
get
New Guinea. They don't get the
Nothing's
Philippines.
Perfect. Nothing's perfect.
You know what
perfect.
I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
They don't get. You know what I mean? Don't really do Saipan.
Not really. Not
they,
as,
they
not,
don't
no.
do Tarawa. They barely do Iwo. They do it, but they barely do it.
Yeah. They just kind of dip their foot into it. But I can empathize with having too much to cover and not enough time.
You landed on the goddamn beach and everything smelled like sulfur. Sulfur sands, just living in that for a month.
Not a good time. Not a good time. Bring some suntan lotion. All right. Mm-hmm. Bring some never mind. Winter of 1942 to 1943, the Allies are making some advances. They're breaking through. You got Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery is pushing through General Erwin Rommel's Africa Corps at El Alamein and moving west across Libya. Meanwhile, General Zhukov, he has his counteroffensive at Stalingrad. The U.S. captures Guadalcanal. It's a good time. Right. Yeah, as far as that, not a good time for the soldiers by any means, but the tide is turning against the Axis.
Yeah, man. I'm a World War II guy. So, like, all these names of these generals, they're cool, but like, it really, what got it done with a goddamn M1 and a Jeep? That's what got it done.
I wouldn't know. This is too deep. This is too deep a cut for me.
You know,
man.
Goddamn M1 rifle. That's what got it done. You could look at it. You can it can freeze. You just piss on it, bang it a couple times.
That's American as hell.
Yeah, it is very.
And after this is around the same time, winter of 42 or 43 is where FDR advocates unconditional surrender. There's not going to be any slippery shit going on. There's going to be no separate peace between the USSR and Germany in particular. You guys are unconditional surrender, right? May 1943, you have the Washington Conference or Trident. FDR is advocating a cross-channel invasion into Germany, but Churchill, he's like, we've already made headway in North Africa. Let's go up Italy and knock out one of the major Axis powers from the war. But then also Churchill is making plans and kind of throwing his weight behind, not initially, but he comes over for Operation Overlord on May 1st. They plan for it for May 1st of 1944. Yeah. However, it doesn't occur until June 4th, July 10th.
I'm sorry. We're talking about deep cuts. I keep, because it was raining a lot and that's why they were trying to,
Goddamn rain's gonna let up.
Yep. All right. That's another John Wayne movie.
Man plans and God laughs, right? June 10th, 1943, you have the invasion of Sicily and the largest amphibious invasion of the war at that time. You have Italy is knocked out. They surrender in September, and then like battle-tested Nazi troops are sent in to occupy Italy after that occurs. So you've got to push your way up the boot, you know?
Yeah, they do the ridge lines. They have like these different lines in Italy. I'm forgiving what they're called. There's different lines.
I know there's the Anzio. I know the Anzio bridgehead was held for the price of a few hundred ordinary lives. I know that. All right.
It lost a lot more than
you can't. You can't do deep cut. Yeah, you're not the only one who can do deep cuts.
We could talk about Monte Cassino. We could talk about. I mean, but there's like they just in Italy has like this kind of crazy ass geography. Hills and shit. And just sending people at monasteries. The monastery on top of Monte Cassino.
Yeah.
That they swore the Germans were like calling artillery out of. They're like, we gotta blow up that goddamn monastery. And then they didn't do it because it was a World Heritage Site.
Yeah.
And then they did it because they like fuck it. And then that's when the Germans actually started coming in because they respected it too. started coming in, and then they had more accurate artillery fire.
Oops. Yeah, that fucking sucks.
Everybody went up that goddamn hill. All right, I don't want to talk about Monte Cassino anymore. Okay. It's a lot.
Fall of 1943, this is when FDR also begins to work on the GI Bill, which promises up to 4 years of collegiate or vocational training for returning vets, job counseling, unemployment insurance, all of these perks still in place today. So if you're a veteran returning from overseas to go to, or if you decided to pay for your college through the GI Bill, know that you have FDR to thank.
Also, a lot of discrimination.
Also, thank you for your service. I got
also a lot of discrimination in the GI Bill, and I also administered to Black troops. All right,
yeah.
I just got to add that in every time.
You got to get it in. You got to get it in. Right? Yeah. November of 1943 in North Africa, or FDR is in North Africa. He stays in Eisenhower's lodgings. He's like, hey, you remember the bonus march? You know, meets with Churchill and Chiang Kai-shek in Cairo.
Yeah.
And he meets with Chiang Kai-shek there because he basically invites Chiang Kai-shek because he didn't want to appear to be caucusing with Churchill before Tehran. So he brought Chiang over. And yeah. FDR, he's speaking about China. He says that it would be a triumph to have got the 425 million Chinese in on the Allied side. This would be very useful 25 or 50 years hence, even though China cannot contribute much military or naval support for the moment. And so FDR's also got his eyes on China, right? Mm-hmm. And how things would change, right? Maybe. Yeah. But who's to say what the relationship between Mao and FDR would be if he would have lived. But he was also like, not weird with Stalin, but just oddly admiring of Stalin. But I don't know how much he knew about the Great Terror or anything like that, or if he was just seeing one side of Stalin. You know what I mean?
I'm pretty sure he knew. Like, he knew? The OSS doesn't exist. It just starts in World War II.
It just started.
But like, they have an understanding of like, spy work is around, and they have an understanding of like, oh, that's they're pretty fucked up over there.
They get the vibe. Yeah. So November 27th of 1943, FDR lands in Tehran. You have the meeting of the big three, which is a first meeting at the Soviet embassy, and they're all speaking through their own interpreters. Now, FDR is advocating for some of the just broad strokes of it. I think FDR in particular wants like a stronger Polish state, wants to move the borders west, or borders of Poland west to the Oder River in Germany, and some form of democratic autonomy in the Baltic republics. And Stalin is pushing for, again, a cross-channel invasion of Germany in exchange for his commitment to helping the West take out Japan in the Pacific theater. And Stalin wants FDR to name a single commander to carry it out. And FDR ends up naming Dwight D. Eisenhower over George C. Marshall.
This is I'm not just gonna start. I thought you said George, and I thought you were gonna say Patton for a second, and I was like, come on, dog. One of the greats.
Yeah.
Crazy son of.
So this gets us into the third act, which is legacy. On January 11th of 1944, you have the State of the Union. FDR announces the Second Bill of Rights, or what is more commonly known as the Economic Bill of Rights, which promises, it commits the American people and the American government to the ideas of, at least FDR saying it as an executive, you know, he's saying the American people should have freedom from unfair competition, should have a right to housing, should have medical care, social security, and education guaranteed as citizens. This should be promised to them, right?
Okay.
And I've heard this, John Edward Smith didn't mention, I heard this from Capitalism, A Love Story, the Michael Moore documentary. He says that a lot of these notions, and I did double check some of them, for the Japanese constitution, as far as like guaranteed housing, labor's right to bargain collectively is guaranteed, medical care. These are all things Michael Moore is saying that are incorporated into the reconstructed constitutions of Italy, Germany, and Japan. And it's just ironic that America thought that these were noble enough precepts to impose upon belligerent nations that had been subsequently conquered, yet we still don't have these things here at home.
Yeah, can't walk the walk. I don't understand what you get.
Isn't that crazy?
I don't understand you know? What you understand. They kind of, yeah. Walk the walk, big dog. Walk the
I'll
walk.
Get a, I'll get off the soapbox, but yes, yeah, walk the walk indeed, right? January 16, 1944, Morgenthau gives a personal report to the president and met with FDR on that date, outlining the activities of the State Department, because the State Department to that point had been pretty, had been dragging its feet and been very slow as far as like dealing with Jewish refugees and helping Jewish refugees, supporting Jewish, processing Jewish refugees, all of these things. It had been not as forthcoming as it should be, not as helpful as it should be, moreover. And Morgenthau is pushing for like a new commission or body established that would deal with refugees. End result is the War Refugee Board, which does what it can to help Jewish refugees. And Morgenthau sits on it, I think, and some other guys in FDR's cabinet as well. Spring of 1944, FDR is diagnosed with congestive heart failure, and he's asked by his doctors to smoke less and cut down on his evening martinis, because he was famous for this thing called like the Children's Hour, which was like his nightly cocktail hour martini. I gotta
combine that. That's really nasty. that's really nasty. Okay.
Is nightly cocktini sessions for him and members of his cabinet. He's also recommended to sleep more. And his campaign advisors around FDR try to hush this up because it is an election year, and he doesn't know if he's going to do a fourth term. You know, he has to at this point because America's in a war, right?
He doesn't have to. He literally doesn't have to. And I want to state this again, because this all of these reasons that you've given are used by people in Africa to secure third and fifth and eighth terms.
Yeah,
we're in a war. We're in a state of war. They're part of the country. It's like, bro, we're in a war.
But you caused the war. But you
don't worry about it. Like, so
this is you, man. This is all you.
I am heavily against third term.
Okay. All right.
Anything.
Then on June 4th of 1944, you have D-Day, Operation Overlord. Like Josh said earlier, the rains push off the invasion. They targeted May 1st. Too much fucking rain. June 4th, D-Day. 39 divisions land on the beaches of Normandy.
Yeah.
July 1944, you have the nominating convention for FDR's fourth term. He decides to go for one, although in noticeably poor health. And
best movie about D-Day. People say Saving Private Ryan, The Longest Day.
The Longest Day.
Best movie about D-Day. Point blank, hands down.
I'll put it on my list, man.
Got John Wayne playing a paratrooper. Get them men down from there. Yeah, that's a lot.
I wish I could join.
It's a lot. St. Mary Cleese, come on, big dog. Yeah, man. Yeah, it's a good film.
Check it out. There's a guy, young man, not so young, a little nerd named Harry S. Truman, is named vice president over Henry Wallace, basically because they're looking for like a compromise candidate to balance out the ticket. And he's kind of like the least offensive candidate with a decent enough record. And so Harry Truman is named, and like, they weren't close, you know? And at this point, like, FDR has been, this is his fucking unprecedented fourth term.
Yeah.
And you're just this VP that's this wimpy little VP that's coming in.
Oh, yeah. They don't even invite you to the real meetings.
No, man. He's just like, all right. Yeah. That guy can be VP. I don't give a shit. I'm going to be around. And then sure enough, and then Truman's like, oh, shit. Oh,
yeah.
I'm president, you know? Fuck. Yeah. So January 20th of 1945, FDR is re-inaugurated. This is one of the first times where he's like wearing his leg braces while giving a speech, and he usually didn't do so. And so this is kind of an indication to the public that this is clearly, all of this is clearly having an effect on him.
Yeah.
February 4th, 1945, one of the last big events that FDR participates in is the Yalta Conference. And Yalta is a Soviet resort in Crimea on the Black Sea. There's a general update on the progress of the war amongst the big three who meet again. They advocate the occupation, but not necessarily dismemberment of Germany.
Yeah.
The occupation of Poland, FDR urges, that's what Russia is pushing for. Stalin's pushing for is he's like, hey, Hitler and I kind of said that we would carve up Poland between each other. And I don't know where that agreement still is. I still kind of want to gobble up Poland. I don't know if that's still on the table, you know, especially after you've enlarged the borders of it. Seems I want it, you know.
Yeah.
And FDR urges a blanket commitment to free elections, but in like, I think all nations or in the Eastern Europe. The places that would be under Soviet occupation. He's like, oh, as long as you have free elections, it'll be fine. But there's no real arbitration. And so it's kind of a mandate without teeth. It's again, fairly flexible, but like also non-committal on Stalin's part.
Yeah.
March through April of 1945, FDR, in failing health, spends his last days at Warm Springs, Georgia. His health is failing him. And while there, this guy Shumakov, I'll post a picture of it because I do have the portrait. Does a portrait of him, I think, like either the day he dies or the couple days up to the day he dies, like right as he's basically on death's door, Shumakov does a painting of him. And then finally, April 12th of 1945, while the war is still going on, FDR dies of a cerebral hemorrhage. And hearkening back to the first episode we did on FDR, Lucy Mercer is also with him. His for lack of a better word, his side piece is with him the day he dies. Yeah.
It's better, you know. Yep.
And as far as legacy, just getting some brief impacts because the war was not concluded at that point.
Some people don't have anybody when they die. So a side piece is... You know what I mean?
Because most, a lot of people.
Yeah, but you'll be like anyone. So, if it's, you know, maybe you know, sometimes you're not living right.
Yeah, man. Legacy, Hitler commits suicide the next month. Of course, the war wouldn't end until August with Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Truman's decision. He saw the country through most of the war. The legacy that FDR has and why he's still like not hotly debated, I would say not debated at all, because most people don't want to admit, most people who are interested in World War II don't want to also admit that at one time democratic socialist was president and had a large role in shaping the future of this nation and also was committed to helping out poor people is generally unpalatable to people who are interested in World War II, generally speaking.
I mean, you know, I mean, not to me. I like World War
II. Yeah, I mean, we hit the middle of the Venn diagram. You know, most of the time it's like, you know, one or the other. But there's also, you see that framed in the debate versus like some historians will try to say of like, oh, the New Deal was a waste. It had no impact on the American economy. What really salvaged the American economy was World War II. And that manufacturing was like, you're not wrong, but they're not necessarily diametrically opposed. One was kind of a prelude to the other. They're not mutually, it's not one or the other. It's not that one, you know, was the sole reason the American economy was revivified and the other just shouldn't have been done at all. It's like, now these both kind of worked in tandem.
Yeah.
As president during World War II, like I said, he molded the global role of the U.S. in like establishing sort of, again, I think he was like an imperialist and an expansionist. And he had this thing that I wanted to talk about in one of the episodes, but didn't get to during his second term, I believe in like 1936, 1937, he toured South America and advocated this sort of hemispheric defense, which of course opened the door. Cause it was already, it had already existed with like United Fruit, but just more like neo-imperialism of Latin America. He kind of, he played his role in that, but also founded the UN. Didn't get to talk about the Manhattan Project at all, which also responsible for and like shaping the course of events for decades to come as far as the invention of the atomic bomb. And then he's very weak on civil rights.
Yeah.
Japanese internment is a block. You had something about the housing crisis that you wanted to mention.
It's not a housing crisis. It's just, it's like, so we talk about the New Deal and, you know, maybe we should have had this in the second episode, but you talk about the New Deal and its effect on like African Americans, some of these programs just were in general were just helpful to everybody. Mm-hmm. But in the couple of these, I haven't like done a deep analysis of all the New Deal and how it affects black people, but like there are specific ways in the New Deal that it screws over Black people. It screws over African Americans. Is one example that just comes to mind, just because I saw this John Oliver segment for his show of just about the about housing discrimination and about how basically in the New Deal they basically created the modern day mortgage and allowed, which allowed people who didn't have the money to take out loans to own their homes, right? And they set up the Federal Housing Administration. In the Federal Housing Administration, like bylaws or like how the way the law was written, one of the things is the Federal Housing Administration does redlining. They defined Black neighborhoods, the mixed or ethnic neighborhoods as yellow, Black neighborhoods as red, and then white neighborhoods as green. And that defined where you could get mortgages at. They also did stuff about all the white neighborhoods before they got mortgages. You couldn't get mortgages in Black neighborhoods. It was hard to get mortgages in ethnic neighborhoods, but the white neighborhoods always got mortgages from the Federal Housing Administration or whatever it is. The
FHA.
FHA. So that sets up a situation. Also, the FHA like mandated all these white neighborhoods have a housing covenant that say you can only have white people that live here. You can't sell your house to Black people. So
wow.
So basically what that does is set up a situation where the Black people can't own their homes. They can't put money into like making their homes better. They can't take out loans to do things like that. So, but the white people can. So there ends up being this whole thing about white people owning their homes in 1938 or 34 or 40 or whatever, 45, 49, 50 at rates of $8,000 for the home. Now, if that you're looking at that same home, I think the example he used is Levittown in New York, which is in Long Island. You look at that same home, that was $8,000 in 1940, whatever. Now it's $370,000. And that can account for the gap in wealth between white and Black families.
And of course, the wealth stays in the family is the assumption.
You pass that home. That home also allows you to leverage that to take out other loans, to open businesses, to start things. So just when we talk about some of these programs.
And with the placement of public schools, there's probably better public schools next to these
because
red line drawn neighborhoods, you know.
The green ones are the good ones, the red ones are the bad ones. But your public schools are based on your tax system. On your housing property taxes. So if you don't own a home and there's not like so these things are like these programs are good. In the right direction of things I would like to see, right? But a lot of them are fundamentally flawed with a lot of racism. Now, was FDR like an incredible bigot? I don't know him. I haven't seen that. But like the programs were in a climate and he didn't stop it. And it created a lot of good. But in the Black community, it didn't help. And it's kept us behind, and which was a boost for the rest of the country.
You gotta mention the good and the bad is that if you could do the same set of policies with specific things in mind, I'd be fully behind, you know.
Of course, right? Then becomes the case for reparations.
Yes.
Not even for slavery, just for housing discrimination. It's one of the most purely valid cases I've ever seen in my life. It's the discrimination. Now those people need to be given the amount that is taken here. And those people are still alive. Those are your grandparents. Those are your parents who grew up in these homes.
Much less far removed.
Not that we shouldn't do reparations for slavery.
Of course.
Anyway, I give FDR the same treatment I gave Ho Chi Minh, which is anything that happened under your rule. You're responsible for it. So you know what I mean? So FDR is responsible for, you know, a lot of good things, but also for the handicapping of Black wealth in this country. Like Ho Chi Minh is responsible for fucking those weird pogrom thing. Not pogroms, I forgot what it's called, like cultural revolution type shit that they had going on. All right, And guys, that is gonna be our finale. are ending, FDR. Mm-hmm. It's too much to handle. That spanned a lot of decades. Like went through so many eras and like did a lot. So thank you, Henry.
Of course, kind of
tackling that one.
Next week
is a big one. Next week, what do we got?
Next week, we are going to look at the role of Canada in World War II with very special guest, Mr. Graham K. Correct?
Yeah, it's gonna be kind of sick, man.
Sweet.
It's gonna be kind of sick.
I'm excited.
He's a Canadian.
He's a Canadian. He's gonna set us straight. Set us,
they really do a lot. That's what I'm going.
I mean, you tell him that.
Yeah. All right. We'll talk about it next week. Right. All right. But if you guys, again, follow us on everything, follow us Hard Part History on Instagram. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Do all Facebook, the things.
HFH Podcast, on Twitter.
All those. Yep.
Hard, YouTube, all this type of stuff. Follow me, Joshua B. Stokes, Instagram, Facebook, Henry. Hashtag your name.
Handle. They know my shit.
They know. Henry okay. Just, and you know, I am, yep. I will be this week. I will be at the back of the bus on Thursday, and I will be at Eighth Wonder. I will actually not be at Eighth Wonder, so I'll be in Austin Saturday and Sunday.
There you go.
If you guys are out there, come holla at me and see me do some stand up at Velveeta at 10 p.m. at the Velveeta room at 10 p.m. And then also that's on Saturday, and then also on Sunday, opening up for Jade Catapretta. I do not know the location. I think it's at Antoine's downtown Austin. All right. Thank you guys for listening. We'll see you guys next time.
That's right.
All right. Peace.
Peace out.